right out of the gate. Let's try this for a minute. You guys, thank you for giving me the feedback, and just keep giving me the feedback. I'm not really sure what's wrong, except maybe if the mic is kind of hot. I'll turn. Oh, that's better. Okay, let's try that. Maybe it was an effect I had on or something. I don't even know. I was screwing around with it earlier because I'd got some feedback on the podcast that it was a little weak. So I tried some recordings not being broadcasting. And the recording sounded fine, and I got a little more volume, I guess. So it looks like it's better now. Okay, so this, I did a kind of in-depth, I did a little bit of research on the COVID numbers, and we're going to talk about that in a few minutes. But what I wanted to talk about, first of all, you know, I'm always kind of looking out for hypocrisy for whatever reason. Maybe I'm kind of sensitive to it or not, but I just think it's so crazy when you see hypocrisy that's so blatant that you just, I don't know why other people can't see it or refuse to see it, but sometimes you need to listen to some other people like it's all connected or free your mind to be able to see some things that, you know, maybe some people just have a hard time seeing. But this is something that caught my attention this week that I thought was so funny in a way and so hypocritical that I couldn't ignore it. And this is what it was. So the federal government is, well, of course, they try and ban anything that they think is bad, or they tax it into oblivion, like cigarettes, I guess, would be a good one, alcohol. Pretty much, oh, do you remember when we went through that phase of sin taxes? Like if you owned a really expensive yacht, you got taxed extra. Well, so their new thing, I think this came along because of the vaping industry. You know, the vaping industry kind of started taking a bunch of money away from the federal government because people quit smoking and started vaping. And then, of course, they wanted to figure out how to, you know, reap their tax benefits from people who vape. So they started taxing that and putting restrictions on it. And one of the things they did was they said they didn't want to have flavored vape, which I don't know if any of you have vaped or not, but I vape and I really enjoy having different flavors to vape. If I want to vape something that tastes more like tobacco, you can. I mix all my own vapes, so boy, this is a whole nother subject, really. Maybe I'll talk about sometime. But anyway, you can make a vape that tastes like tobacco. You can make a vape that actually tastes like your favorite flavored tobacco. You can make fruity vapes like your favorite cereal when you were a kid, if it was Captain Crunch or, you know, I don't know. I wasn't really a sugary cereal eater when I was a kid, but you can pretty much make flavors of vape, just about any flavor you can imagine. Like, what was one that not Starburst, but Skittles. So somebody even made a vape flavor that tastes like Skittles. And so I mixed that up one time. It tasted pretty good. It kind of tasted like Skittles. I got it. But my point is, the federal government didn't like that idea because they thought that that would attract children to vaping. Now, I'm going to tell you a tiny bit about vaping, and I really had no intention of talking about this today, so, you know, there goes my time as usual. The federal government thought that kids would be attracted to vaping. Now, this is what I did with vaping. I started vaping to get off of cigarettes. So when I started vaping, I used a lot of nicotine in the vape because I was trying to quit cigarettes. And then as I vaped more and got more comfortable with vaping and got the vaping dialed in just the way I wanted it because I did all my own stuff. I made my own liquid. I made my own coils. I had really nice rigs, still have really nice rigs to vape with. And then I started kind of weaning myself off of nicotine by putting less nicotine in my liquids. So eventually, I just could have a giant cloud of vape with no nicotine in it. And to me, that was very satisfying. It's kind of crazy how many people started vaping and removed the nicotine from their vape so they were no longer dependent on cigarettes and didn't support tobacco companies and the federal government through extreme taxes. But apparently the government didn't like that, so they stepped in and they tried to put a ban on flavored vape, which, let me tell you, I don't know how many people know this, but vape is made up. If you make it yourself, it's made up of propylene glycol, vegetable glycerin, and artificial food flavoring. That's all that's in it. If you make it yourself, it's really cheap. I mean, like, really cheap. So, you know, you can buy propylene glycol by the gallon if you want, and vegetable glycerin by the gallon, and the flavors, the artificial flavoring is the most expensive part, but you only use a few drops per, you know, so much liquid. But my point is, so now the federal government wants to put a ban on menthol cigarettes. And as soon as I heard this, I was thinking to myself, man, that is flipping racist. Now, how could you claim, you know, all this solidarity with Black Lives Matter and be talking about how, you know, we need to pay more respect to black people, and then the next thing out of your mouth is you want to ban menthol cigarettes? Now, you may be thinking that I'm a racist for saying that, and that's okay. I don't mind being called names. Sticks and stones, you know, I don't care. On the CDC's own website, they actually said that young people and African Americans are more likely to smoke menthol cigarettes. And, I mean, they have the statistics all broken down right there for you to read. And this wasn't like this week or something. This was years ago. And I'll tell you who else knows. Tobacco companies know who smokes menthol cigarettes. So, you know, I just heard this and I was thinking, this is the craziest thing. And why aren't... this is going to sound just stupid, but I'm just saying, why aren't black people pissed off at this? I mean, why aren't they, and I don't know, when I was in the service, you know, I mean, there's all different races in the service. You're living with guys on the ship or living with guys in the barracks or whatever. And yeah, I mean, it was like, if you were smoking and, you know, you were smoking with some black people, they were smoking menthols. You know, it was the thing. So, yeah, I know, Moose Girl, not only black people smoke menthol, but the majority of menthol cigarettes are consumed by blacks. I mean, that's CDC stats. You can believe it or not. I'm just saying. But anyway, and then it's just so crazy that, you know, they're going to take that away, but, you know, try and also say that, you know, we need to... honor African Americans and blacks and, you know, respect them. And I do. I mean, it's just silly to me and hypocritical that you turn around and say you're going to ban menthol cigarettes kind of in the same breath. But hey, along that line, somebody was saying, and I wish I would have kind of marked this down, but somebody was talking about how this whole Build Back Better is going to progress and how we need to get more African Americans, people of color into positions of power in different corporations. As a matter of fact, they actually recommended that part of the goal is that all corporations are going to have a person of color in a position of authority as a CEO or one of the officers of the company, and that they're going to give them 51% of the stake in that business. In other words, this is kind of part of that whole being woke agenda, that social, economic, and environmental score that you're going to have as a corporation. And I was also thinking to myself, now, this is also kind of unfair, because like the economy is getting ready to tank. We're going to have the highest inflation rate that we've probably seen ever. And so it just sounds horrible to me that now is the time that they want to make this kind of rule, is that you have black people have 51% ownership in a business right before you're going to tank the economy. It just doesn't seem right. I don't know if you guys know this, but there was two things I kind of wanted to talk about as far as prep goes. One of those things was that they're expecting to have a gas shortage this summer. They say only 60% of the gas that we're used to having at the pumps is going to be able to be at the pumps. And the reason is because they can't find enough drivers to drive the gas to the pumps, to the gas stations. And I thought, that's kind of crazy. What happened all of a sudden that, you know, there's going to be a gas shortage? It's not like there's a shortage of gas. There's a shortage of transportation to get the gas from where it comes in to, you know, the actual pumps. And I was talking to a patient this week about it, you know, because I didn't really hear what the reason was other than there was a shortage of drivers. And that person was telling me that I guess now more and more of these tanker companies are independently owned. They're not owned by the big corporations. Although, you know, here's the problem with kind of living out in the country. I don't see commercial vehicles a lot. What I see a lot as far as commercial vehicles goes is log trucks and, you know, kind of some service trucks, like the heating and air conditioning people and heating. And I was thinking, who else do I see a lot of? Well, anyway, so you get the idea. So this is what I'm saying. It's not like there's a BP truck come down the road where I live. There is a highway nearby, but it's not an interstate. And, you know, this is a rural area. I mean, we're out here in the sticks. So it's not like we have a bunch of BP trucks or Shell trucks or Texaco or, you know, any of those gas tankers coming through. So I really don't know what it's like. And I try and stay away from the city as much as possible, so I don't ever really get like an exposure to what's going on in the world as far as commercial traffic goes. But I guess this patient was telling me that these independent companies can't afford the insurance. And I guess, well, obviously fuel is flammable. I'm not sure it's considered hazardous, but I guess you have to have that hazardous rating as a truck driver or company. And apparently the insurance on that is getting really high. But for whatever reason, there's plenty of gas. We just can't get it to the pumps. So be prepared for that. And then, kind of along the same lines, chicken is going to be in short supply. So, of course, those of us who have the ability, I mean, I'm already set up with chickens anyway. In fact, some of them are looking kind of tasty right about now. I'm kidding about that. But because meat birds and laying hens are very different, if if you didn't know that. But anyway, so I'm probably going to order some meat birds and raise them myself. I figure if we raise about 30, I mean, I'd like to almost have a chicken a week, but that's an awful lot of birds to raise at one time. So I'll probably do 25 or 30 birds. And I'll just tell you kind of briefly the way I do this. I make this PVC kind of cage, but it doesn't, let's just say it doesn't have a bottom. It has four sides and a top of chicken wire. And I you know, it's fairly big. It's probably 20 feet on a side and about a foot and a half tall, maybe 2 feet tall. And I just put the birds in that on the, just on the grass. And then every day, just move that whole thing. I just drag it, you know, across the ground. And it's kind of flimsy. It wouldn't keep out a predator, that's for sure. But I just move it to different parts of the pasture so that they can, number one, they get fresh new ground every day. And they can kind of clean up whatever is in the ground. If there's any, you know, grass seed or weed or, you know, grubs, I don't know, chickens sometimes eat some bugs, I think, but they do a pretty good job of cleaning up, and they fertilize as they go, so that's kind of nice. And anyway, oh, well, of course, and I feed them also, because meat birds, they kind of reach maturity pretty fast. Matter of fact, the first time I raised meat birds, I kind of let them go too long, and it was kind of funny. I kind of thought of them as little pigs, because meat birds are bred just to produce muscle. So they basically don't do anything else other than sit at the trough and eat, especially after the first, oh, 3 or 4 weeks. Like, they might walk around a little bit the first few weeks, but after, like, about the fifth week, about the fourth or fifth week, they really don't walk around much at all. They're just big, fat, just kind of stupid birds. And, you know, they kind of, I mean, there's times I literally watch chickens never move. They just sat next to the feed and just would eat whenever they wanted to eat. That's probably not true. They probably actually did move, because I don't have time to sit and watch them 24/7. But it was kind of like every time I'd go down there, there'd be some chickens that are just sitting right next to the feeding trough, just, you know, waiting for their next little peck. Anyway, so if you have if you have the facilities to raise some chickens yourself and to store them and stuff like that, you know, and there's a lot of places process chickens for you if you don't want to do it yourself. We're kind of fortunate. We have a guy down the road, oh, about 8 miles away, that's a kind of a small processing, meat processing place. He'll do chickens and rabbits. He'll even do some goats and turkeys. But anyway, this guy, you know, he's just a little kind of country operation. It is really clean, nice operation. So he does everything right there. You know, so you can get your birds, you know, get them to the mature point and then just cradle them up and take them down there. And he slaughters them and plucks them and, you know, gets them all ready. Takes them a couple hours to do. It probably takes them an hour to do 20 or 30 birds. I don't know. It's pretty damn fast. You know, and meat birds, like I said, are very different than laying hens and stuff like that. They put on meat a lot faster. So if you do start going to look at this and you're not familiar with it, then be sure and look for the meat bird variety versus a layer or some other bird. And, you know, like recently I noticed in the last few years, actually it's probably been around for 5 or 10 years or more, but they have kind of a hybrid that's a good range bird and puts on meat pretty fast, which is kind of nice, because then you can just put them in your coop if you have a coop with other chickens. Like our chickens, you know, we let them out every morning. They have a coop that they go in and roost at night. And then they have an area they can get into, you know, that's kind of open, but not completely open. It's all chicken wired in, the top, the sides, the door. So they can't get out and predators can't get in, because predators will get in and, you know, cause you loss. But if you get that hybrid chicken that's a kind of a meat range bird mix, you can just put them in your chicken coop and they'll go, they'll just follow the other birds. They'll go out and, you know, wander the property and kind of, you know, fertilize your plants or your garden and pick bugs or weed tops or whatever. And that's kind of a nice way to do it, because then you don't need the chicken tractor. I noticed Rob Works kind of put in the chat there a chicken tractor, and yeah, that's what they call it. But that hybrid bird is pretty cool, because you don't need it. Anyway, so I looked into, I was looking into the COVID virus numbers. I know everybody's probably tired of hearing about COVID, but I really wanted to look at it myself and see, you know, what happened with why the COVID numbers aren't, like, truthfully reported. So I had to go, I wanted to go and find out what the kind of rate of infection of influenza was before we got COVID, because I know 100% that influenza didn't disappear because COVID came. I'm going to have a drink. Hang on. We all know that COVID, the influenza is still here, has been here. It didn't disappear. Or maybe, maybe because COVID came along, it wiped out influenza. Now, I don't think one single person in the world believes that. But also, nobody will really say, like, you don't hear on the daily reports from anybody that, you know, influenza is either on the rise or had so much, you know, had so many cases of whatever respiratory illness, you know, is attributed to influenza. But we know it didn't disappear. I mean, I'm convinced it didn't disappear. Yeah, it just got rebranded. It just got put in with all these other with the COVID numbers. And you know what? This is kind of crazy. So I actually went to the CDC website, because, of course, I guess that's, you know, one place where you can get all these numbers. But on the CDC website, this is some of the stuff that they actually said. So, and I'll give you the numbers in just a minute, but they said the provisional death estimates provide an early indication of shifts in mortality trends. Timely, now this is kind of worrisome in a way, timely and actionable data can guide public health policies and interventions for populations experiencing higher numbers of deaths that are directly or indirectly associated with the COVID-19 pandemic. It says daily totals reported by CDC COVID-19 case surveillance are timely, but can underestimate numbers of deaths because of incomplete or delayed reporting. It says COVID-19 was reported as the underlying case of death or contributing cause of death for an estimated 377,000. That doesn't matter. Don't worry about that number right now. And it says numbers and rates of COVID-19 deaths include deaths for which COVID-19 was listed on the death certificate as a confirmed or presumed underlying cause of death or contributing cause of death. So what's kind of crazy is CDC, on their very own website, where they actually, I guess, make, you know, statistics available to anybody because it's public information, they actually tell you straight up that, you know, if it says on the death certificate that somebody died of COVID, well, then, you know, whether they actually died of COVID or it was a contributing factor, which, you know, we've seen extreme cases of that. You know, a guy dies in a motorcycle crash, you know, head is, you know, he's decapitated, and somehow it's attributed to COVID. I think pretty much anybody who shows up at the hospital, you know, in respiratory distress and then passes away, they probably just labeled it as COVID. And there's a lot of other reasons that you can die in respiratory distress other than COVID, you know. So in my little research, I had to go back a couple years because, of course, they quit counting influenza last year. Like, you don't have really good numbers for 2020 influenza because we all know it disappeared. But just going back 2 years, I found that in 2018, now this is interesting. In 2018, the CDC, I had to go read the 2018 report, you see. The CDC estimated that influenza was associated with more than 35.5 million illnesses, more than 16.5 million, more than 16.5 million medical visits, 490,000 hospitalizations, and 2,000 deaths during the 2018 influenza season. Then in another report, I saw that during the 2017-18 season, the percentage of deaths attributed to pneumonia and influenza, because the CDC kind of combines those two things, so you could die of pneumonia and not have the flu, but they would put it, kind of wrap it all together, probably same as they have done with COVID. It said the percentage of deaths attributed to pneumonia and influenza was at or above, get this, the epidemic threshold for 16 consecutive weeks. That was in 2017-2018. Now, why didn't we have some kind of a national lockdown in 2017-2018 when this so the influenza and pneumonia numbers were so high that they actually considered it an epidemic for 16 weeks out of the year? You know, and obviously there's a reason why all of a sudden when COVID came along, you know, we had to have all these kind of lockdown and stringent rules. And something else I found when I was looking at the COVID numbers was the lowest numbers of death. I got to find this. Might take me a minute. But anyway, the people that were affected the very least were children from 4 to 14 years old. And I got to tell you, like I was cruising. So Rochelle and I usually go shopping, kind of our weekly shopping, Saturday mornings. And so we're cruising through the next biggest town, which I think is 15 or 20,000 people, but they have kind of bigger stores and stuff and, you know, more access to more of the stuff we need. Like there's a bigger farm store there, so we go and get some feed there and, you know, any groceries that we have to resupply every week, we do that. And then we do once a month a big shopping at like Costco or whatever. But anyway, so we're driving through McMinnville, the next biggest town. It's 13 miles away. And I see the high school girls out on the ball field with their masks on. And I'm thinking to myself, number one, they're so far away from each other. I think the closest people have got to be the batter and the catcher, and I bet if you actually measured it, they're at least 6 feet apart from mouth to mouth. And why? I mean, they're the ones who are probably the healthiest, will be the least affected by any possible infection they might get, whether it be COVID or influenza or anything else. And how stupid is it to participate in a sport with these masks on? I just don't even understand it. I do understand it. I know it's all about control. I know it's all about control and, you know, making sure the people know that, you know, the government has taken over and you're not allowed to do anything without their consent. It kind of reminded me of something You know, I don't know if I've ever said this before. So when I went to college, before I went to dental school, I went to college and I got my degree in biology. And I studied, because I was at University of Oregon, we had one guy there who actually was the, so he worked with Watson and Crick, who Watson or Crick are the two guys who kind of figured out the DNA double helix. And this guy was actually not an intern. What do you call that? Not a resident. What do you call those guys who, it doesn't matter. So he was, you know, he was the office boy, I guess. I can't think of what you call him right off the bat. But we studied molecular biology, which at the time we spent a lot of time studying this virus called phage lambda, which it's really interesting because, they're the doctoral students, the ones working on their doctorate, you know, and they work under these professors, and I don't know, I'll think about it eventually. But anyway, so we were studying this virus called the phage lambda virus, because that's what this guy, that was this guy's thing, is he was fascinated by this virus. And I remember then, so that was in 1980, I remember this guy talking about, I think his name was Stahl, by the way, S-T-A-H-L, I'll look that up, just in case. He did write a book, which was not fascinating unless you're into viruses. But his name was Stahl. Anyway, but this is the craziest thing. I was on my way to going to dental school. That's why I was getting a degree. It really didn't matter to me what degree I was going to get, although I had some interest in animals, biology, so I thought, you know, I would study biology while I was at University of Oregon, and, you know, if everything else fell through, I would have that to fall back on if I didn't get into dental school. Well, so this guy was talking, at that time, in 1980, he was talking about how viruses work, and how viruses use their host cells machinery, their cellular machinery, to replicate themselves. And then he was talking about how if we could, you know, get hold of that, if we could control that process somehow, and then he described how they were working on doing it, that we would be able to eventually insert DNA into anything using this virus or a technique similar, or a virus similar to this virus, and insert kind of any kind of machinery, kind of, I'm talking about, you know, biologic machinery, into organisms. And of course, now, of course, we have genetically modified organisms, and that's exactly how they do it. They use part of a virus, they use part of a bacteria, and then they insert that into host DNA. So even back in 1980, it was kind of, I was already aware, and, you know, and I was only half interested in it at the time, but what I did know at the time was that this was not a good idea. I just, for whatever reason, I was just thinking, man, I don't know if we ought to be putting one organism's DNA into another organism. And, you know, the funny thing is, you know, science, not the science, but science will always, actually, it may be the science, they will always, kind of like the government, when the government is trying to tell you, sell you a program, they'll always try and make it sound like there's some humanitarian reason why we should do this. And I always fall back on this one specific example I have in my mind about the government saying that they're doing something, you know, for whatever humanitarian reason it is. And it's this, the Born Alive Infant Protection Act. And if I talked about that before, I'm really sorry to be repeating it, but it's just such a vivid example in my mind of the government saying one thing and doing something maybe completely opposite. So I'm just going to tell you what the Born Alive Infant Protection Act is. I'm almost sure I talked about this before, but I'm going to waste your time for two more minutes talking about it. So the Born Alive Infant Protection Act is this. So if a woman goes in for a late-term abortion, like very late-term abortion, and the rules used to be that the baby had to be killed before it was delivered. Because if it got delivered alive, well then, you know, guess what? Somebody's stuck with a baby. Well, the Born Alive Infant Protection Act is this, that if during an abortion attempt, a child is born alive, it is legal to put them in a sink or container or whatever and protect them until they die. It kind of creeps me out that we would actually, I mean, because you can't call it the we're going to slaughter babies when they're born alive act, so you call it something completely different, the whatever I said it was, Born Alive Infant Protection Act. The craziest example I can think of the government naming something that it absolutely isn't. But I guess you really could say, well, yeah, it really is what it says it is. Well, yeah, sort of, but not. I wanted to get back to my degree in biology. Oh, yeah. Oh, I think that was it. Is mostly I did study a lot about viruses. I am by no means an expert in viruses. I think I'm much more of kind of the macro level animal person, and really not so much that anymore since I became a dentist. But my goal, I guess, was if I didn't become a dentist, I would be a park ranger or study marine biology or you know, some other such nonsense. But I think it sort of worked out that I became a dentist because I really love being a dentist. And so far I'm not really ready to give it up. Oh, I know why I went into that whole thing, and it's for this. I'm going to have a drink before I start this. I know some of you are thinking, those of you who have listened to me for more than one show, is if he has a drink, he's going to forget where he left off. And you're right. That could happen, but it didn't. Okay, so when I was like in high school and college, and I had this enthusiasm for biology, I read a lot of books. Yeah, everybody can have a drink. Sure. Round on me. So I would read books on different things like the series All Creatures Great and Small was a series of books I read. And one of the things that I remember either from that series or from a book that was recommended after I read that series was this person was talking about eagles. And they worked at a place where eagles were taken if they were injured, and they were either rehabilitated or they lived out their life in this sanctuary because they couldn't be out of the wild. But one of the things I remember, you know, because at the time I think, you know, you have these kind of romantic ideas about life, and so you think that, like, for example, you think that eagles are these majestic birds because, you know, because that's what you were brought up thinking, the bald eagle, the symbol of America, you know, soaring free. And, you know, you kind of have these kind of romanticized ideas about different things. I could take a little sidetrack and no, I won't. Yeah, maybe some other time. Okay, I'll do it. This will sound terrible. Sorry. It'll probably offend some people. Sorry. When I was in the public health service, and I'll get back to the eagle in a minute, I promise. When I was in the public health service, the public health service serves areas where they can't get doctors, dentists, nurses, pharmacists, etc. to serve. So they have this uniform service that they'll assign you to different areas in the country. Well, one of those areas was the Northern Cheyenne Indian Reservation. I was assigned there for 3 years in Lame Deer, Montana. So, and you know, at first I was thinking, oh, this is kind of cool. I'm going to go work on a reservation, you know, on an Indian reservation, you know, the Native American, you know, and all the lore that went with it. And I was kind of big. I kind of have to laugh now because it's so funny looking back on it. I was just thinking about how great that was going to be. And it was kind of a step up at the time for me. I was going from being a chief dental officer of a solo clinic, which meant there weren't any other dentists, to the chief officer of a clinic with two other dentists, a hygienist, and about six to eight dental assistants, you know, and it was a medical facility. It was an actual inpatient hospital facility where you had a dental clinic and you had access to all of the other kind of things that go with it, hospitals, inpatient and outpatient kind of stuff. And yeah, I thought that was real romantic until about, I don't know, I was probably there 2 or 3 days and a Native American started. And I'm not kidding. I remember this so clearly. This Native American was yelling at the at an administrator right down the hall from the dental clinic, and I kind of stepped out to see what all the commotion was about. And he was kind of looking toward me and screaming this stuff about, you know, Europeans taking, you know, they think they have the, you know, they're holier than thou and blah, blah, blah. And I was literally looking behind me to see who he was talking about because I was so naive at the time. And after the whole kind of shouting stuff was over and that health services administrator, you know, she kind of nods to me to come over there. And I said, man, what was that guy so upset about? And she goes, well, he's upset because you're the chief dental officer and, you know, you're a European Caucasian, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so there went my, you know, kind of romantic notion about what it was going to be like being on the reservation, being a dentist on a reservation. It actually turned out to be really pretty, pretty awesome experience. My eyes were opened pretty clearly from that experience also. Okay, so back to the bald eagle. So I was thinking in the last couple of days how appropriate it is that the bald eagle is the symbol for America, especially now. I think especially now that we've kind of gone through this last year. Because the person who wrote that book about the bald eagle sanctuary actually de-romanticized the bald eagle for me pretty clearly. And they said, you know, you think that this bald eagle is so majestic and loves freedom, but really, when we get these bald eagles in the sanctuary, they're so happy to just sit in their sanctuary and have somebody bring them food that they really don't care to go out and about and, you know, kind of get food for themselves. They say they'd be happy spending the rest of their lives just sitting on their perch and having you bring them food. And I was thinking about that with this, you know, I didn't mention earlier the reason that chickens are going to be in short supply is because they also can't hire enough people to process chickens. It's not that there's not enough chickens. It's that there's not enough people willing to go process the chickens. And that was kind of my point about the bald eagle being, you know, a perfect representation of the people of the United States, or a representation of the United States of America. It seemed as though when you had liberty, you know, you were so proud of having liberties. But as soon as somebody put you in a cage and sent you food in the form of a government check and maybe, you know, they call it stimulus money, you became quite content to sit there and take the food and not really go back out and go to work. So it was kind of an interesting, I think, and I'm not talking about everybody, I know that, but, you know, I mean, I can sure understand if somebody would pay me the amount of money, okay, let's say even 60%, let's say even 50%, if somebody paid me 50% of the money I make to sit at home, I'd sit at home. I mean, I'm getting pretty close to thinking about sitting at home. Yeah, that's not going to happen. I would always find something to do, but I am kind of thinking about pulling the plug, but I just don't see myself retiring really anytime soon. I mean, maybe something will happen where I have to because I can no longer perform well as a dentist, but I'd like to work less at work and work more at home, but you know, right now I think I still have a lot to offer at that office. Let's see what else, if I had any other fun stuff to talk about. No, that's not fun. No, that's not fun. Oh, hey, one thing I did want to kind of mention, you know, it's kind of funny, or maybe it's not funny. I get the impression from people, it seems like after World War I and World War II, I think everybody kind of thinks that all of the powers that be are happy with where they are and what they have. But I think nothing could be further from the truth. I think as long as there's been human beings from different, let's say, countries or geographical locations, or however you want to divide people by race or geography or whatever, there's always been wars. And I think we've been kind of lulled into this kind of false sense of security that, you know, after World War I and II, there wouldn't really ever be another world war. But the thing is, you know, resources, when countries, you know, populations explode, or I just think in general, I think people who come into power only seek more power. And sometimes that power just comes from resources, or can come from resources. And I just don't think we're done having gigantic wars. And I think that we've gotten so complacent, kind of in a way, that could come to us at any time. And I just don't think we would be ready. I used to think that the United States, because so many people have guns here and there's so many bullets purchased in the United States, that we would probably stand a pretty good chance. But anymore, I just don't believe that anymore. I think people have kind of got lulled into this idea that, you know, well, the borders are set, we're good now. And I just don't think that's the truth. Anyway, looks like my time is up. We're going to go grill some fish for fish tacos. And what else? We're having a little peach cobbler because Shaq, the birthday boy, didn't want to have a birthday cake. He wanted peach cobbler. That sounds delicious. And I'll see you guys all next week. Hey, thanks for hanging in there. Bye.